Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallsl.info. Today's study explores the Torah reading Naso, covering Numbers chapter 4, verse 21, through the end of chapter 7. It also picks up the parallel reading in Judges 13 on Samson. The focus is on the lessons from the Nazarite vow.
So in this Torah portion, which covers a number of different topics, but obviously, as we've noticed, it covers dominantly the discussion of Nazarite vows. So there are other topics being discussed in there as well. So I spend most of my attention or time today discussing the details of not so much the vow itself, but some of the misunderstandings of its purpose and how it is used, biblically speaking, as far as how it's used in our Bibles compared to how it's commonly interpreted or thought of in Nazarite vows. Before I get there, assuming there's always the question regarding other topics, we can jump into it. But before I get there, something I want to point out, which I think is more of a spiritual topic of discussion. Oh, Larry, go ahead. What's your question, Larry?
I was going to ask something about what was just read, so it's kind of not pertinent to what you're talking about.
Go right ahead. No, you can ask. Go ahead.
Well, it's a little bit esoteric. I was watching someone talking about genetics and about the when a seed has to die, and we always take that to mean, well, I guess it kind of rots in the earth, and then it springs up. I always wondered, why did he say that? The seed doesn't die, the seed germinates. But it turns out that there's some genetics in there that has to do with the X and Y chromosomes, and I don't understand, I don't remember the whole thing. But there is a certain bit of that has to actually die by cell death. What do we call that? There's a name for
aptosis.
That. Aptosis has to kill off one set of those genes in order for that cell to germinate. So what he was talking about, if that's the case, if that was a correct analysis, what he was talking about is absolutely accurate. Part of it had to die in order for it to germinate.
That's interesting. I'm familiar with apoptosis itself. I've never looked at that concept. You said it was you were watching this on a television program. Is that correct?
I wish I remembered. I was watching it and I thought, well, that's very interesting. But I didn't make note of it, so I don't remember. I'm gonna have to try to find it.
Yeah, that's a curiosity. Cause I don't know enough about seed germination to know how that process works. I've always accepted the traditional viewpoint of them dehydrating themselves to death, because that's how you germinate seeds before they can activate. But not all seeds do that. So some seeds don't actually dehydrate. They actually go from, like for apple seeds, for example, go from a moist, alive state into germination state immediately. I don't know enough about that, but it is a curiosity of mine.
It makes sense, though, that our master would know that accurately and explain it, even though we think, we have this tendency to think, well, he was way back there, or they didn't understand all those things. Well, who didn't understand those things? He understood them.
Yeah, he would have known a better grasp of how everything was supposed to work. I know Messiah wasn't taught or explained everything by God, but some things he would have had far better understanding than others. Okay, so go ahead. In my discussion here today, before I jump into the topic which is dominantly covered in the Nazarite vow, there's a few details I want to bring up, which I think is more of an interesting. These are spiritual concepts, so we're going to go through them relatively quickly because they're not terribly complicated, just spiritual based on their nature. You will note that in chapter 5, I'm going to bypass, by the way, the rest of the counting of the men and the people from Levi. It's more of an extension of the previous set of our Torah portion. But nothing wrong with it. It's just I'm not going to cover it today. In the case of chapter 5, when it discusses the initial removal, the first four verses, removal of the contaminated people. So when we read this section, at least when I read this section, and going through these first four verses, discussing the nature of this removal. Now, if you recall, in the book of Leviticus, it discusses the type, in these certain sections, the type of diseases that we address and communicable diseases that are on people's skins. We call it, most of the Bible discusses leprosy, but it also includes certain forms of eczema and other types of diseases on skin as well. Yeast infections, see that of that nature. So it covers a few of them, and then, of course, they're categorized and described how it's done in the book of Leviticus. But this is our first example of actually being applied, meaning as far as it actually being people physically removed from the community. And I found it a little bit on the, what's the right word? It, on the remorseful side to me, personally. Nothing wrong with removal of disease, but imagine yourself as the person being removed. So you have a family, you have friends, you've been a part of the Israelites for at least the past year. You went to the Exodus, you had the wall on both sides of water and saw Pharaoh. All these things happened to you and you experienced them. But now at this point in time, a year later, and a year and what? A month? A year and a month thereabouts, a year and a few weeks later, you were then told, okay, now move outside the camp, away from everybody else. You are now under isolation because God is at the camp and you can't be with God in that capacity. And initially, it kind of feels heartbreaking because you've obviously experienced your own life. You struggle with some disease, whatever these may be. You already feel in some ways an isolated person because you have disease on you and you can't get rid of it. But and now it's like, almost feels like a sense of rejection. Well, now God's rejecting me too, kind of thing. That's an interesting emotional, spiritual state. And by the way, when I say spiritual state, I personally, Daniel Agee, categorizes emotions as a spiritual concept. That's why I put them. So you may not put them there, but I do. I see because I can't physically touch an emotion. I can't with my senses can't detect it. My mind can't detect it, but my emotions are still real. So I categorize them under the spiritual aspect of things. Some people categorize them a little differently, but that's okay. That's where I put it. So in this instance, I have this scenario where people are being rejected, so to speak. But I think of that is the spiritual idea of isolating a diseased person from the community and from God. Actually, the point to put out there, money is also a spiritual concept too. Absolutely. It puts its value on something that does not intrinsically have value. There are many different spiritual ideas. So, but I have this individual that've been kicked out of the camp. I'm not going to say how long they were, whether it was their entire lives, a few weeks, how long it took for to heal, or if they ever healed. Obviously, if it was leprosy in particular, no one healed from that. They all died from that. So that was not an instance that you would just be isolated until you died. But in these instances, if I have this spiritual idea of God saying, I can't have this diseased person in my presence, or your presence either, you need to isolate them, put them over there instead and keep them separate. And I find that as a spiritual idea in a physical manifestation. So what I mean by that is the concept we get from Proverbs 22, Proverbs 13, and 1 Corinthians 15 about the idea of something that is not compatible with us, and we embrace what is not compatible with us, it will contaminate us. So we have this basic principle of good does not corrupt evil, but rather evil corrupts good. So if I go in a situation, I'll use this example of me pretending I'm good, whatever that means. I'm not going to argue what that means. If I go in a situation amongst a bunch of evil, I am at a higher risk to myself of adapting or modifying my behaviors to accept or tolerate more evil around me. Much like as Pat had prayed earlier today regarding the individual who's going to the Philippines to minister or try to convert or talk to a bunch of Muslim peoples in that community. It's a risk to him, both physical risk as far as like violence to him, but also the types of behaviors that are tolerated, you'll be exposed or surrounded with them. And sometimes those behaviors can rub off on us. That we can start, for example, I'm sure some of you have experienced this in your lives at some point, those of you who are adults. You have a situation where people tell, jokes, ha, funny, they may be dirty jokes, for example, and you still laugh. And then it becomes more common around you or your work environment. A lot of swear words floating around. You hear it all the time. And sometimes eventually after so many years or months, it comes out of your mouth. That kind of thing can happen. So it's the nature of that process. So the idea of isolating these people on a physical realm is also applicable in a spiritual realm. So I'm not saying we can never interact with people who are corrupt because that's the case. We'd all be dead. So we do it for people. But the principle is still the same, is to avoid the companionship of those who are evil, i.e. who don't sin. And we have that obviously taught to us through 1 Corinthians 15, discussing that concept of resurrection of the dead. You have an ultimate goal in mind. You have an objective in your existence. I want this objective. My eternal life is my goal. Well, amongst that route, I have to avoid the things that will take that away from me. And that includes people who act in a very negative or evil fashion. So the same principle applies. We also have, of course, Aesop's most quoted statement about a man is known by the company he keeps, from Aesop's fables, the author Aesop. So there's a lot of issues there, a lot of examples there, though it is hurtful in the conceptual idea that me being kicked out of the camp, I've been rejected by not just people, but by God also, that emotion is there. And I have to obviously do self-examination, ideally, or I'm going to flip the other side and become just angry and embittered. God willing, I won't be at the angry and embittered reaction. I'll be in the emotional or self-examination side, but obviously I'm not there, so I can't say what I would or would not do, honestly, because I'm not, neither any of us there. But it's a hard thing to feel rejection. Rejection is a very harsh emotion, spiritual emotion inside of us. And so that would be a risk of feeling a rejection type of concept. It doesn't matter whether or not we're back there in the Israelites, 3,500 years ago, or in our neighborhood, or in our own, amongst our own friends or family. That idea of rejection hurts. It hurts a lot. And it can cause scarring within emotional or spiritual scars. So it's a very difficult thing to see and read about, but reality is, that's the idea we're supposed to understand. That rejection is such a traumatic thing that we'll do whatever we can to avoid rejection. And that includes our behavior. Our behavior will try to accommodate what we can so God does not reject us. Do what God says so we are accepted instead of rejected. That kind of idea. It is an emotion that is intense, and it's not an easy one to cope with, but we have to accept that that's a real thing that we have to address and handle. So I don't want to spend too much time on that necessarily, but I do want to address that concept. Hopefully I didn't miss anybody on that basic principle, but it kind of matters to some level on why we do what we do and the risks we take. Okay, what I really want to talk about, however, some of the questions of that, is some of these other items talked about in chapter 5, as well as in the Nazarite vow. I will spend two minutes on this one thing regarding this whole girl thing and checking because she cheated on him or not cheated on him. That's always a funny topic to me. It's funny because it seems somewhat blown out of proportion. The idea is being that while she got tested, so she may have cheated on him, but how come there's no test for the guy versus there is one for the girl? Oh, Anne, you had a question? Put your question, Anne.
Yes, it's really a difficult thing with this going out to camp thing, because I think everybody has like maybe a little scab on their skin, and there'd be an awful lot of people out of the camp. I mean, it's like, well, okay, it just shows everyone has under sin and all of us are unclean. But at the same time, I think about the discrimination it causes, and then we start thinking inside the camp, oh, we're better than them outside the camp.
Right.
And, and then we got this bias, well, where does anti-Semitism come from anyway? Maybe within the camp. I mean, maybe that's a possibility.
You have a legit point. That's a topic that happens in the idea sometimes for people when, like, for example, we pray, oh God, I want to do something useful for you. Fill in the blank and what it is. And then we do that thing and God allows the opportunity that we say, wow, look how great I am. Oops. Just boot me back out of the camp, will you? Tammy, you have a comment? Go ahead, Tammy.
Yeah, going back to briefly to the issue with the quarantine, I mean, those three levels of people, you have everything from a very temporary situation where maybe you were in a situation where you had to help bury a family member or something like that. Very temporary, but nonetheless, you need to be separated for a while. And it kind of ratchets up from there, from a more serious, more long-term situation to the point of the leper, which is a very long-term situation usually, right? But right. So it's kind of interesting that those categories of it goes from like permanent, almost permanent leprosy to like a very temporary quarantine or whatever. But
and all of them get jumped together. Yeah,
and they're kind of all lumped together. But nonetheless, if you've read the Torah closely, you can kind of see that there's different categories of people. Like I said, with the person who had to bury somebody, that's a very temporary situation. Well, it's a quarantine of 7 days or 8 days or something like that, and then few things you had to do to kind of get back, but relatively smooth process to come back. Whereas a leper, that was a much more involved situation, a much long term being out of the community in the first place.
Right. And I imagine it, for example, in the case of somebody like the body example you give, the person's not going to have the emotional trauma, I don't think, out of that. I mean, yeah, whatever. I'm there for a few days, whatever. I'll get over it. A week later, I'm fine. But the leper is where I would have I would expect a more traumatic emotional experience in that, because they already are intrinsically rejected, because leprosy is obviously highly contagious. But then they have not only the intrinsic leprosy, but God doesn't come and fix me. I have to get booted out from God's presence too, and that's where like that would be a harder emotional experience or spiritual experience. On top of my flesh, like falling apart, right? My flesh is falling off of me. It's in great pain. I can't functionally do anything. And now God's saying, no, I'm not going to fix you. I just want to kick you out. Oh, thanks.
It's levels. And then maybe touching on a little bit what Anne was talking about, I was actually reading an article from Chabad and I was also reading through a commentary on the story with the jealousy issue and all that. And they pointed out that if the husband was also committing adultery, that the miracle wouldn't happen. Or if he's doing the same thing he's accusing her of doing, God's not going to punish her for doing something the husband's doing. And it leads me to something that I was thinking about is that a lot of times the accusation is projection. Mm-hmm. And so this process basically exonerating the woman being accused of something that she hasn't even done, it can kind of bring up a lot of that kind of issue too.
Right. And that's an interesting topic you bring up, which we're going to talk about a little bit about that before I go to the Nazarites, because there's a lot of, you know, ideas, concepts. I don't have, obviously, there is no like record in our text of this ever occurring, ever doing this. So I couldn't say if it ever happened or not. I mean, it actually applied to anyone. So maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, who knows. One thing I was talking to my daughter Samar about, she was doing the Torah portion at the other church this morning, discussing it. And a few days back when she was studying for this, she had talked about this topic, see what's going on here. I pointed out, well, if you think about it, there's no test for the man, obviously, because they don't have a male test. And so at this time in history, you know, 3,500 years ago, there'd be a very, very small, tiny number of men who could theoretically pass the test. And I say that because most men had more than one wife. And so if you go to say, she says, hey, he slept with another woman. And it's like, well, yeah. men wouldn't pass that test. Very well, at least. It's comical to me, haha, now, but obviously wouldn't be necessary then. And so the test would be kind of weird to try to apply it to a male, because all the males would probably fail who had more than one wife or any concubines. They would have a problem. And concubines and multiple wives were common. And I'm not going to make any kind of excuse for such things, by the way. I'm just specifying what reality once was. And so things have changed. Obviously, today is not the case. But at that point in time, you had multiple wives. So yes, you slept with many different, all of your wives at different points in time, or concubines, how many you had throughout your life. And women tended to not live very long. So most women died in childbirth, so you had a lot of wives anyway, which is another weird, weird cultural thing, which is not part of our culture anymore. But there's a lot of oddities. And I point out to her that my daughter, the test itself is a spiritual test, because realistically speaking, you take some water, put a little dust in it and some ink, you might get a tummy ache at best, but most likely it'll do nothing to you. Harmless. So it's really not a physical like ooh no, this is going to kill me, unless you believe or spiritually fear it. So for example, if a woman perceived herself as being guilty and she's afraid of this test, the idea one rabbi had argued, I can't say he's right, this is what his opinion was, that she would be afraid of the outcome of the test and then confess. And because it's confession, all she's allowed to get is divorce. I mean, because there's no consequence. So, for example, adultery can be a death penalty, but you must have two witnesses. A confession is not actually accepted in a Jewish court of law as a guilt. It's a confession, so you can receive a divorce from it, but you can't be executed for it. So it's kind of a strange thing. So he was arguing that if she feared it enough spiritually before she took the drink, she may choose to just confess. And then he says, okay, great, here's your divorce, I'm out of here. But that was the guy's opinion. I can't say he's right or wrong. Tammy, another question?
Well, that's always a question, just a response to that, because one of the Jewish sources I was reading too actually mentioned the fact that this curse or whatever, this thing that's written has Hashem's name on it. So that was supposed to amplify the idea of you're going to be drinking in God's name. And if you're going to drink God's name, you know, you're drinking that in. And if you're lying and you've actually done something sinful with another man that was not your husband, you're literally drinking judgment. So how about before you drink this judgment, make a confession if you have done something inappropriate with another man? So that was kind of the point of it, is bring her to confess if she had done anything wrong before drinking it. But obviously, if she's innocent, she's going to be willing to go through that and drink it. So the idea was to kind of force her to confess if she had done something inappropriate.
Which makes logical sense. The one thing about doing something wrong against somebody else, for example, let's pretend you did something wrong, whatever it is, I don't care. Did something wrong and you're found guilty of the wrong thing. Well, our Torah has like restitution, just pay back what you did plus 20%, yada, all these rules about what you did something wrong. Well, in those paybacks, confession is not a requirement in those. And so if I say, my sister, say, Joy, you're guilty of doing some crime, whatever the crime is. And you say, no, I'm innocent. Well, the court of law found you guilty. Guess what? You're paying for it anyway. Whether you agree being confessed or not, doesn't make a difference anymore, because now you're guilty anyway, so you're paying for it anyway. So the confession is not a required thing to go through the consequences. So if she, in this case, for this woman who theoretically may or may not have cheated on her husband, the confession, she's not required to confess to still go through it. But if she does, then that helps, alleviate the court case, and also shows that she still has reverence to God. She still fears that God, that religious belief, she still believes that God is something to be feared. If on the other hand, she's something else and doesn't care less, God, what's that? Who cares what it is? It's just a made up whatever. Well, then she didn't have no fear at all. She wouldn't care. And I don't know, again, there's no record of me actually going through this, so I can't tell you what actually did or didn't happen. Who knows? Anyway, I hope the other comments on that. The one thing I do want to bring up is on this point is verse 15. It talked about no putting oil or frankincense on the offering, because it's supposed to be an offering to remember this iniquity, as it describes. Don't put it on there, because this is a offering of remembering iniquities. Well, it tells you if you put oil and frankincense something, that's the opposite. If you remove it, God said, I'll remember the sin. How many of us want God to remember our sins, transgressions, and iniquities? Big fat is none of us. Okay. So the point is, you put oil, you put the fat, you put the incense on the offering so that God does not remember your sins, transgressions, and iniquities. It gives you the symbol definition of what the fat and the oil being added to the grain, what it means. What's that oil represent? It's representative of God not remembering your sins, transgressions, iniquities, and also the frankincense too. It's just a funny thing. It just helps us define what certain terms and symbols are in our Bibles. Anyway, I'm going to move on, because I want to talk about the Nazarite vow. And hopefully no comments about the girl and the other thing.
Anne has a comment here.
Oh, go ahead, Anne. What's your comment?
Okay, so I think about the woman and the consequences of not confessing, or what about it if she did. Her consequences are just to her, but at least it doesn't kill an animal in her sacrifice as the other, all the other offerings that you got after that. I mean, you got seven rams, seven bulls. I mean, something's got to give its life for you and for what you did. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, well, you'll be limping for a while, or you may be limping the rest of your life, or you may not walk, or you'll be
maybe
exonerated, you know, forgiven for it. So
I hate to go home that night if I was the girl, I was the man, the husband, go home that night after the test and she passed the test. I hate to go home that night because that night would be not very pleasant. You accuse me of what? What? A very unpleasant household. Yeah, yeah, this is your favorite soup. Here, drink this, honey. Sorry, that's an off topic, but it's just funny. Okay, I'll move on into the Nazirite vow discussion. Oh, yes, Gary, you have a comment? Go ahead, Gary.
I was thinking that the remembrance part was actually kind of interesting because I, at least when I was growing up in church, most of the time when we read through passages like this, the focus was always on, oh, the woman must have done something wrong, otherwise her husband wouldn't take her there. I don't think that really reflects the heart of God, frankly. I mean, even nowadays in our society, it's hard enough for a woman to walk down the street without getting accused of things. So for me, this actually, to me, is more of a, I guess just, you know, what I see in it that's important to me is that this is a supernatural exoneration of the woman when she passes the test. You know, if she was taken to court, people might still gossip for years after the fact because, you know, things aren't always exactly where they're supposed to be because it's a human court. But in this case, when she's exonerated, she is supernaturally exonerated. There is no open door for gossip after this. And interestingly enough, with this part about the remembrance, you know, she gets to be remembered that way, that she was clean and she was pure. Yep. And there was absolutely zero doubt. And for me, that's like my biggest takeaway.
Yeah. Which is, it is supposed to be a spiritual test. It's supposed to be a spiritual walk. I mean, all of our walk with God is for spiritual. So it makes sense that in this instance, you have a supernatural, quite correct, correct, I agree with your point. The supernatural exoneration, it goes a long way. It shows the character of the individual, both of the husband, but also obviously of the woman herself, that God is saying, hey, there's nothing, no problem here, nothing happened, move on, which is good. It shows a lot of the gossiping would have, people who were presuming or assuming or making assumptions along the way, oh, well, God said no, clearly I was wrong. Then they're all guilty of gossiping. Oops. They have their own sins. Yeah. It's the offering for gossiping. Oh crud. Okay, so I want to talk a few things about the Nazirite vow thing. We know obviously Nazirite vow chapter 6 discusses obviously there's no grape products, so grape is out. And it also is inclusive of other wine or alcoholic beverages. So it's a grape specifically, but then it also includes any alcohol or alcohol forms. I can't spell alcohol. Alcohol, maybe? I think it's how do you spell alcohol? Anyway, so grape alcohol products. There's no hair doesn't get cut, right? And then what was the last one? Oh, no corpses, no dead bodies. So in these instances, I mean, for the most part, we don't have a lot. We have a few examples of Nazirite vows in our Bibles. There's a few of them. Not a lot, but there's a few. We have obviously Samson, one of the more famous ones. We have a semi or mostly Nazirite vow with Samuel. We have a bit of a Nazirite vow in another sort of Nazirite vow, semi, with John the Baptist. So there's a few examples of Nazirite vows as far as what kind of person they were in the Nazirite vow, but or what kind of characters they activated. So in this instance, we covered Judges 13, the initial few details of Nazirite vows for Samson. But there's a couple of things I want to bring up to you in this concept. So we have the basic principle. All right. This is shocking or strange. This is designed for either male or female. It makes a difference whether they're male or female. And they're designed to basically be a kind of like a priest, sort of. Not really, but kind of. In that they can hang out in the temple. They can do certain priestly activities, not high priest stuff, but as far as assist along the way if they wish to work inside the temple. There's a few things they're allowed to help with in that capacity. And of course, obviously be witnesses to the people around them as far as the kind of character or person they're at. But in the objective of the Nazarite, in chapter 6, verse 2, the goal of all these things, these three things you're required to abstain from, right? The let your hair grow long, don't touch dead bodies, and don't eat grape or wine products, as it describes it, it's for the sake of God. That is the goal of the Nazarite, for the sake of God. They ask, what does that mean? I mean, for example, I could say, I'm going to, I don't know, I'll fill in the blank, not eat chocolate for the, yeah. Okay, that's unrealistic. Not eat chocolate for a whole year because I want to dedicate my life to God. Okay, does God really care if I eat chocolate? Probably not. Not really. I mean, maybe he might, but I've never seen him write that down, so probably not. So reality is, if I make these weird vows, these strange vows, and I do it for the sake of God, what does it actually mean? What am I actually accomplishing with it? What am I doing with this vow of mine? Is God really hate grapes that much? The answer, of course, is no. He made them, so he doesn't hate grapes. Does he hate short hair? Of course not. We're supposed to keep our hair from growing too long. So that can't be the case. Does he not like human corpses? Well, he may not. I don't know. He's made quite a few human corpses, by the way. He makes his own. He kills a few people along the way. I can't say he likes or doesn't like them, but either way, he's made a few. So these are all kind of odd or esoteric things. They're spiritual in their nature. I get the basic idea of a human corpse being unclean and such, and being flesh. And cutting your hair is supposed to be a outward appearance of grapes of wrath. We're talking exactly about that, grapes of wrath, in a few minutes. The outward appearance is obviously seen by the hair, so we'll know what's going on. Because obviously, if you have long hair at this time in history, they would say, well, clearly they're Nazarite, because guys don't wear long hair, typically at this time in history. I'm not saying they can't. I'm just saying that clearly it was not common, at least amongst those, the Israelites. If you had long hair, they assumed you were Nazarite. Although how would that apply to Absalom? He wasn't an Nazarite. He had really long hair. Well, anyway, that's David's kid. He was his own weird guy. Anyway, so we have these details, which I don't understand all of them. I'm not going to pretend to understand all of them, but we're just going to discuss them a little bit. So one of the things it brought up was this wine thing. So the hair, I kind of understand the hair because it identifies that you're part of the Nazarite vow. Okay, that's fine. Dead body thing, I don't like dead bodies anyway. I don't know about you, but I don't hang around them. Maybe some people do. It's not my job, so I don't hang around dead bodies. But I will point out the dead body thing. Two of our Nazarite vow guys didn't do so well. Okay, so, for example, how many dead bodies did Samson touch? I don't know. He found every dead body because he made them. He made lots of dead bodies. So Samson touched lots of dead bodies. All right. And then we have Samuel actually made his own dead body once. Samuel did too. Remember the king, Agag? Yeah. Who slaughtered him? That would be Samuel killed him. So we have a subcategory called dying. That's not dead. It's just, so we have an argument for the peanut gallery that said, no, Samuel touched a dying person until, whatever, come on. You're splitting hairs, really small ones. So these two guys, they did experience dead bodies. They had their own run-in with dead bodies. I can't say that John the Baptizer had dead bodies. He himself became one, but I don't think that counts. So John the Baptist or Baptizer, he may or may not have run across a dead body in his life. I have no idea. It doesn't record. Obviously, his parents were old. So if they're in fact as old as the Bible appears to make them out to being, they probably died while John was still relatively young. So he may have run across their dead bodies. But I don't know. I wasn't there. it's possible they outlived him. I don't know. Anyway, so in these stereos, we have these dead body. So we have a few failures on the dead body side, at least by two, and possibly John. I don't know. Did John have long hair? I have no clue. It doesn't discuss long hair for John. So maybe he had long hair. Maybe he didn't. What was that? Oh, yeah. So Lorianne pointed out the movie said he shows him have long hair. So the movie was right. Therefore, he had long hair. Could be. I don't know. We'll defer to the artistic license and claim he had long hair. Why not? Maybe he had long hair. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. I don't know if Samuel had long hair or not. I have no reason to think he did. Samson obviously did. But I do want to bring up this one thing about the grapes, the alcohol. That's what I want to talk about a little bit about this, because this is what was interesting to me, at least to me personally. You may think something else, but the grape alcohol part, I want to focus some more attention on. So most of us get the idea of alcohol causes harm to most of us. Yes, it does. Okay. We get in trouble with alcohol. It's a bad thing. We don't usually hang out with alcohol. Well, those of us who are trying to stay with good self-control, avoid it. Those who don't care, that's their own problem. So we have alcohol and grape thing. Now, God made grapes. You can't say grapes are evil. He made them. He made the leaves, he made the seeds, he made the skin, he made them all. But and that's why Baal doesn't get to eat this stuff or any products thereof or any other strong drink products. Note, God does not say you can't eat apples, right? Even though you could theoretically make apple ciders, you can make alcohol out of them, but you still have to eat them if you're not, but you just can't have alcohol. So you can eat the product of the grape, the apple itself, but you can't eat the alcohol from it. I don't understand it, or the vinegars from it too, either. Again, I don't understand them. I don't have to. But I want to bring up some inconsistencies, which helps us understand a little bit about the key behind this particular symbol, right? So inconsistencies is where we get information from. If everything's consistent, we don't learn much. We have errors or variations. We learn a lot from errors and variations. That's what teaches a lot of stuff. So I have a question for you. So Samson, with the Nazirite vow, has to avoid grapes. So we'll call Nazirite, or I-T-E. I think it's how you spell Nazirite in the English translated word, kind of a weird word. So they have to avoid grape products. Now, Jesus symbolically was called Nazirite because it's Nazareth. It's kind of a play on words. He did not avoid grape products, by the way. He drank alcohol. He even made alcohol out of wine. So even the Nazirite vow, if you're going to dedicate yourself to God, who is, by the way, this applies to non-Levites, because Levites are already part of God's work crew. A Nazirite vow is not part of it. Everyone wants to be part of it. They want to attach themselves or be belonging to the work that's associated with the Levites in some capacity. So Nazareth has to avoid grape and alcohol products. And no one, I think, of this Christian side would ever argue that Jesus was not working on God's behalf. Clearly, he was. You get that point. Okay. But Jesus, however, he said, hey, people, I drink. He said so. So he drinks alcohol and he obviously consumes some grapes of some, because that's an alcohol product. And he even makes it. So he drinks it and makes it. Drinks and makes. So that make him not a Nazirite? Well, by the definition of the rules, correct. He would not be a Nazirite vow. But does that mean God hates alcohol? Well, no. Because guess who made alcohol, by the way? God did too. he made all the fermentation process. So it's kind of a strange scenario. We learned a little bit about this. This is a scenario we have somebody whose whole life is dedicated toward God and do God's existence, God's work, that kind of thing, at least his whole recorded life. Is it control God's work? And yet that isn't a problem or a concern of Messiah's. It isn't. It's not his big concern in any capacity. So because this is an interesting point of example. We also have, for example, we have the Apostle Paul. I can't remember the guy's name. I think he was talking to Timothy. I could be wrong. So forgive me if they're about the wrong student of his. One of the students, he said, hey, for your stomach, you have some health struggles. You should drink some wine. Don't drink the water. By the way, if you go to foreign countries, don't drink the water. Okay. That's important. You don't know what's in that. The alcohol is usually a little bit safer. I think it's Timothy. Don't drink some water you have some stomach problem. I don't know what it was. I never heard of a stomach problem that the alcohol fixed, but whatever it was, don't drink the water. So he drinks a little alcohol. So we have the apostles at least one of Paul saying, hey, it's not such an evil thing to drink alcohol in this instance. So, okay, so there's got to be something about the alcohol that isn't about, or the grape product isn't about alcohol itself. Is it God that he hates them? I don't think so. That makes any sense. Jesus didn't seem to hate them. The apostles don't seem to hate them. We're not discussing drunks. It's a different story. We're talking about the product itself, not the abuse of such products. The abuse is his own problem. So, but in this instance, I would pose an alternative viewpoint. All right. So we have the grapes themselves, obviously Nazarites have to avoid any grape products, but grape products themselves are not prohibited or evil in God's eyes. So why would God put this on a Nazarite and not on all Levites, for example? Now, the high priest can't drink while he goes to work in the temple, but other than that time, God doesn't care. So it's not a requirement for the priests, but it is the Nazarite during their whole vow process. And there's something that's curious about this, and I have a few ideas, and I'll bring a few up to you in thought throughout our discussion here for the next 15 minutes or so. So in this idea of alcohol and grape products in general, but alcohol as a whole, we have a few examples. We have obviously Leviticus 10. That's the death of Nadab and Abihu, by the way, when Aaron's two sons offer foreign fire and God kills them. Then immediately following in the first 20 verses of Leviticus 10 discuss the topic. Immediately following their deaths, God says, don't drink when you're about to enter the temple or do any kind of work or associate with the temple. So God's pointing out, hey, alcohol doesn't belong here. Now, I'm not saying that Aaron's two sons were drunk. I have no clue. I wouldn't know. I wasn't there. But God does say don't drink. And his reasons for not drinking is discern holy versus unholy. Holy compared to unholy. As well as he discerns clean versus unclean. This is God's reason for don't drink. You priests, when you're doing work, don't drink, because you will confuse set aside versus not set aside, being common, and clean versus unclean. You will mix them up and make mistakes. So don't drink. So it makes sense. Okay, don't drink. I get that. I can get that from Leviticus 10. So when they're working, don't drink. Now, God doesn't say in your own private time, your own business, whatever. We're talking about what God's doing. So if I personally, Daniel Agee, have a problem throughout my life, throughout my days or my weeks or months, distinguishing between common and uncommon, I shouldn't be drinking at all. It's clear I can't drink. That would be a bad thing. If I can't tell between clean and unclean during my daily life, I shouldn't be drinking, because that's pretty bad. Lorilla, you have a comment? Go ahead, Lorilla.
Yeah, so it goes back to the grapes. I'm not an expert on this, but I have spent more time than I wanted to in vineyards. And I've seen what the grapes look like, and there is a high moisture content around there, so they develop mold more quickly than other plants. And raisins, when they wrinkle up and dry in the sun, they get a lot more dirt in them, so that might have been why they weren't supposed to have those, because they're harder to clean, and especially in a desert situation, I think it might be a little bit harder to. I mean, I'm just
access to water.
Yeah,
that could be. I don't know. We have we have a few other examples. There could be something phenomenal. It's like specific thing about grapes themselves. I don't really know exactly, because I wasn't. I don't know enough about them. But not that some people do, but some people don't. It's not my area of study. So it is curiosity about some of these grape details or grape products. I would pose a few more additional facts or additional points out to this. So we have the example of these grapes themselves. We have obviously Noah getting drunk. That's a common example. He planted a vineyard, got drunk, okay, and his son or grandson did something weird. I'm not the detail behind that necessarily. Now, even though Samson himself was a very flawed person, okay, we get that. He had his problems, his issues. We don't have record of him actually drinking any alcohol. Yes, he did go through a vineyard and killed a lion, but there's no indication he was eating the grapes. I know Judaism argues he probably was, but they're just guessing, by the way. It's truly a guess. He wasn't there. They weren't there. So, but I want to point out one thing to the details of this Nazirite vow that I think helps explain a little bit, in my mind at least, about the grape details. And the biggest thing is that if you look at Samson's life, his whole life, from beginning all the way till its end, note that throughout his life, his body itself was not his. He's a super strong guy, right? Really strong guy, right? His whole life. Was that his strength? No, it wasn't. So imagine for a minute, you or I or anybody else, your body is no longer yours. It doesn't belong to you anymore. What it does, what it doesn't do, is not yours. Yeah, we're all controlled by God, so to speak. As Danson pointed out, Samson, it stresses in Samson's life that God's spirit comes upon him and he has this enormous amount of strength, the burst of power, right? So if your body isn't yours, who does it belong to? Well, it belongs to whoever has control over it, right? Yeah, whatever master it follows, whether slave, sin controls your body, or righteous controls your body, it's not yours. It's a slave to one of them. And in Samson's case, we have multiple instances of him going through this enormous burst of strength to kill off these various Philistines and such throughout his life, even in spite of all of his weird, flawed character issues he may have had. For the most part, Samson's life himself is a disaster. I mean, it just really is. You look at his whole life, his personal life was a disaster. But his body belonged to God. So his body was God's tool and God's function. And I bring this up because if I look at grapes, it affects my body, doesn't it? Like wine affects my body. Not mine too, but it's part of it. As far as it affects my being, my flesh and blood. Doesn't affect my spirit necessarily. My spirit can think and work outside of that, sort of. But it's mostly a body effect. So alcohol products do that. Hair is a body thing. Like it's my body. I can see it. Does my spirit change if I have hair that's this long versus hair that's that long? No, it doesn't change. My spirit's the same. My body hair length just changes. Might smell more. I'm not sure, but it'll just change. It doesn't change my spirit necessarily. In the case of touching a dead corpse, does my body, does my spirit change to touch a dead corpse? No, my body becomes dirty. So in the case of Samson, it describes it that his body is always, God overtakes or takes control of it. And of course, obviously with Samson's willingness. So I would argue that in this, with these rules, these dedicating myself to God, it's not necessarily a mental or spiritual dedication, but it can also strictly be a physical dedication too. It's allowed to be that way. We'll discuss a little bit about that as we go on. Yes, Tammy, you have a comment?
Actually, according to many Native American cultures, there is a spiritual component to keeping one's hair long. There are stories of Native American like scouts that when they had their hair long, that they seem to have a supernatural ability to be able to navigate and know where to go, that when their hair got cut, then they lost their ability to be scouts. They actually lost their connection to the earth, so to speak, and weren't able to scout as well to be able to find where they were going and needed to go. So there is a spiritual connection to one's hair.
That's interesting. I'm curious if that is a God spirit connection or a demonic spirit connection? Because water wishers, the well wishers, people with the little sticks, they try to, the cartoons show them with sticks, bind the water in the ground. And they've done a lot of tests on that and determined it's actually demonic influence that determines that because they put them
I would disagree with that because I can do it.
Disagree with that?
Most people can do it.
Curiosity.
Most human beings can do it. And this is why it's electromagnetic. Because water flowing underground creates a current. If you are holding little metal rods in your hands, and you just hold them very loosely, and you're walking along, and if you happen to cross a underground river and those things move, you have electromagnetic current. The water flowing under your feet that you cannot see is an electromagnetic current, and that's all you're detecting when you do that.
That's interesting. The study I was reading about that had tried to take these water witching people, and they put them in this sealed off room, and they put water under the a tub under the ground in the room in this space. And they're trying to detect if they could figure out where the water was, and none of them were successful. But the water wasn't moving; it was a tub of water. Maybe there's something curious about that. But anyway, I won't go into too much detail about it. But I don't know how much spiritual influence is God-based versus not God-based. That was my point. I can't say for certain that the hair thing is a God-based spirit or any kind of spirit has him. I don't really know. But I do find it dominantly speaking, though, the dedication of a human being is really the goal of the Nazirite. A Nazirite's goal is to dedicate themselves, whether it's physical or spiritual, selves to God in some capacity. And God doesn't have necessarily a use for our bodies at all times. Maybe he does occasionally, but not necessarily always. As I look at this, like, well, okay, Samson, you have this dedication of your body to God. The Nazirite vow in chapter 6 is supposed to be dedicate your body to God. And God says, well, don't eat any grape products. And I'm curious, this is Daniel's opinion here, I'm curious if that's connected to the grapes of wrath idea that Jeff had mentioned earlier. But the whole, because in that grape of wrath discussed in Revelations chapter 14, and actually let's go there real quick. I should go there because I'm curious if this is a possible detail trying to make itself semi-known. So in Revelation 14, it talks about this whole grape thing, this God's wine press. I'm curious about what this means, but I have a sneaking suspicion that the answer is in chapter 19. So Revelation chapter 14 discusses about God's wine press, his grapes, right? This is the idea of grapes. This is where the symbol comes from. And jumping all the way down to verse 17. Another angel comes out. This is a whole, by the way, this is in the middle of the tail, the last end, I guess, of the trumpet, trumpet blasts and such, where bold judgments come. So verse 17 of chapter 14 of Revelation. Another angel came out of the temple, which is heaven, also having a sharp sickle. Another angel came out from the altar of the power over fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust your sharp sickle to gather the clusters of vine out of the earth, for grapes are fully ripe. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it in the great wine press of the wrath of God. The wine press was trampled out to the city, and blood came out of the wine press up to the horses' bridles, for as it says, my English says, 1,600 furlongs. I don't really know what that necessarily means, but that's what it says. And I said, okay, well, that's an example of a wine press. I wonder if the wine press, which of course is associated with grapes, whether the wine press and grapes have a spiritual connection in that capacity. In this case, we're discussing death. So lots and lots and lots of death, because the blood of grapes is associated with the blood of a human being. Messiah gives us that symbol as well. So I'm curious if there's also some, again, connection to that capacity. But I found more interesting, me personally, when I was studying this, was that in Revelation 19, which discusses it as well, it discusses also this idea of the God's wine press. But in this, jumping down to verse 11 of Revelation 19, talks about, again, something which is I find interesting and possibly gives you some clue as to the grape thing that God has issues with. So chapter 19, verse 11, I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes like flame of fire, and his head were many crowns. He had a name written on no one knew except himself. He was clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name was called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white, clean, followed him on white horses. Out of his mouth goes a sharp two-edged sword. A sharp sword. And with it he should strike the nations. He himself will rule them with the rod of iron. He himself treads the wine presses of the fierceness of the wrath of the Almighty God. Pause. Okay, we'll keep reading in a minute. So, okay, so I have the wine press that the angel harvested earlier, right? And dumped, which obviously are human beings, dumped in God's wine press. And this guy's job is to, like, himself is he's the one pressing it down. He's the crusher, right? The crushing feet, so to speak. He's followed by others who are not the wine press crushers, right? there, he says that others have followed him with these all with white linen and such on the robes and such. And he has blood. He has blood on him, but not on them. But that itself is an interesting symbol that we have what we believe is obviously Messiah's example. And we have those who are following him who are not pressing wine. They're not associated with the dead, all the dead dying people, right? But he sees one. He has it as robe and on his thigh written King of Kings and Lord of Lords, right? Verse 17. That's not an angel standing in the sun. He cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come gather together for the supper of the great God. So who's eating the wine? The birds are. The birds are the ones eating all the wine. I use the wine in quotes, wine. It referring to all the dead bodies, right? The birds are. Not the others who are following Jesus, but the birds are. For the great supper, I've got to go ahead. Verse 18. That you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and those who sit upon them, the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. I saw the beasts, the kings, the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him, beside the horse against his army. And the beast was captured, though within the false prophet who worked signs in his presence and such, by which he deceived others, sorry, deceived those who see the mark of the beast and those who worship the image and such. I won't go through all of the cast a light like a fire. So we have this example of this wine press symbol, this grape symbol, blood of grapes. Oh, you're right, blood of grapes. You're right. That's Genesis 45. Good call. The blood of grapes is again grapes associated with blood. So we have this wine press detail associated with blood. Obviously, in Genesis 45 discusses it too, and I'll talk about this as well. So we have this connection. Jesus obviously made the connection pretty heavily himself, with the exception of Revelation. So this grape thing is associated with blood of some form, and look who doesn't eat it. Meaning, those who are following Jesus behind his horse, his white horse, he's got blood on him. Those guys and people and girls in white linen and such, they aren't eating any. The birds are, but they aren't. So it's interesting that we have this association with the death of those who are wicked, and those who are following Jesus, following God, don't partake in their deaths. Meaning they're not benefiting from their deaths. It's like that's a curious symbol. And it's associated obviously with wine, grapes, wine press, blood, they're all attached together. So it's a curious symbol in that in this dedication of a Nazirite, the idea of I want to follow God, God, I want to dedicate my body to you. And God says, okay, you'll dedicate my body to me. You're not going to participate in the death of the wicked. Because they don't. They aren't. Jesus does it, but they don't. They're his army, but they don't. They're fighting. Jesus is doing all the work. So they're supporting him. You know, hoorah, hoorah. Behind him, but they're not the ones who's doing the work. He is. So it's a really curious symbol in that I'm curious if it's possible that the grape symbol, even though it says obviously no alcohol either, but no grape product, says grape leaves don't make wine. They don't. Grape seeds don't make wine. They make oil, you can crush them, they don't make any wine. But those are prohibited as well. But I'm curious if the symbol behind the Nazirite vow and the voided grapes is also a symbol of death. Because God uses that as death repeatedly over and over throughout the Revelation story in the form of blood and the grapes. We also have, of course, our Torah explaining that the blood is the life of the animal. So you must pour it out of the ground and not consume it. So I'm curious if the grape connection is a type or a symbolic connection to death connection, and that don't partake or participate in death. I don't know, but I'm suspicious that might be a connection in that. Because then the death is a physical thing. Like my body dies or it doesn't die, right? That kind of idea. So it's possible, just like the dead corpse thing, there's a combination of death. And the death that Jesus is talking about, and the one that Revelation talks about, well, Revelation specifically, but also all of the offerings, for example, talk about, are all death due to sin. They're all death from sin, transgressions, iniquities. They're all based. The death of all the animals that die, by the way, the vast, with us it's a party, the vast majority of them are all for sin, transgressions, iniquities. That's a large percent of them, at least the ones that are described. And we have, of course, obviously, the death of people, the death of Messiah, the death of all the kings in the Revelation story. They're all focused around death itself. So I'm curious if the same blood concept that's associated with death is also being, God is attaching it to the grape symbol as well. I don't know, but it's my suspicion. I mean, that's what I want to talk about a little bit, to understand a little about that, as far as what that symbol can possibly mean as to why that is the case, why God broke it up that way, or may have included that into this story. But either way, in each of these Nazirite vow scenarios, we have obviously Samuel and 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel discusses this topic as well, in that the objective of the Nazirite vow is to dedicate your body, your flesh and blood body, to God. Right? That's the goal, to God's purpose. You're dedicating your flesh to God's function. Whatever he has in store for you, whatever your future is, it's your flesh. As opposed to the polar opposite viewpoint, which I do not subscribe to, which is dedicating your work, meaning your efforts, like, you know, God, I want to, you know, teach people about Jesus, whatever, the gospel. That's fine. But those aren't Nazirite vow details. Those are actually like my work details, as opposed to my body details. We have Samuel as a body, Samson's a body, John the Baptist is obviously a body. He also did work too, but he's a body as well. They have their physical body being dedicated to God in some capacity, which I find a curious thing in the symbols that God gave. I don't have all the answers, but I want to talk about the idea of what's going on here and the symbol behind this grape idea, and how God reuses the grape symbol as a death and life symbol, and how the Nazirite vow is supposed to avoid the dead corpse, but also avoid the grapes. And it may be avoiding the death, because all those deaths that the grapes represent are death from sins, death from transgression, death from iniquities, to avoid those partaking of those as well. It's just a suggestion or an opinion of mine that there might be a connection between the grape idea of avoiding grapes, as well as the blood from sin, transgression, iniquities being shed too. And of course, those who follow Jesus don't get to participate in those or partake in those deaths, rather those the birds do instead. That's what I'm going to bring up. Hopefully it made kind of sense. Any comments or questions regarding this Nazirite vow topic? Hopefully it's not too crazy. It's kind of off walls, so to speak, in some ways. But the Nazirite vows, I've run across a few people who tried to take a Nazirite vow that I've met over the years. And their interpretation of it's kind of a specific one, that they're interpreting what that means. And I don't necessarily agree or disagree. I find it curious. But what's interesting is how each person interprets the Nazirite vow, even modern day, differently than how I've interpreted. Tim, you have a comment?
Yeah, so going back to these three main prohibitions, the prohibition against grape products, you know, the idea of the grapes and the wine symbolizing death, so that might be symbolically avoiding death. Then you're literally avoiding death by not having any contact with corpses, right? But then this hair thing is a little weird. So the only thing that I could think of in terms of the hair being symbolic of death is that when you cut your hair, whether you do it yourself or you're paying somebody to do it, that hair gets discarded on the ground, and usually then it gets swept away. So you're cutting off a part of yourself and discarding it. And so by not cutting your hair, you're basically keeping yourself intact and not allowing something to be taken off of you and be discarded. Because at the end of your Nazirite vow, if you don't have a lifetime vow, what do at the end of the vow?
Cut it all off.
You cut it off because you're starting a new, you're making a break from your Nazirite time to your no longer Nazirite time by cutting your hair. So by refusing to cut your hair, you're maintaining your connection to your Nazirite vow, maintaining your connection to life in that sense. Because once you cut that hair, you're basically making that symbolic break from that vow. And you can now at that point, you can just go to your regular life, whatever that life is going to be.
You have an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. That could be a connection as far as to not cut the hair. And if you make a mistake to cut it and start over again, maybe there is a death associated in the symbolism there too. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. As Lori pointed, you cut off and donate to somebody. You could do that too. Yeah, bringing them happier life. Maybe, you know, maybe there's some symbolism there.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.